There it was, right there in the front. You interested in Akiba? No, I'm dead serious now. I gotta play a little bit with you every night. Here, it just sounds so glib, doesn't it? One of the Jewish sages, the redoubtable Rabbi Akiba, in the 2nd century A.D., had the courage to state bluntly that, quote, the 10 tribes shall not return again, end quote. That must be regarded as the verdict of history. Boy, that's impressive. The redoubtable Rabbi Akiba. But now, if you go research it a bit, modern research conducted by zealous and learned Jews confirms, now I get, he's so mad at me for not showing him Akiba, he ran the tank into my... I'm reading him now, Bob. Modern research conducted by zealous and learned Jews confirms the constant testimony of that people that they represent the tribe of Judah and the Levites only, and that they do not know where the 10 tribes are. This is a Jewish position. One of the latest contributions to this subject is to be found in a series of articles contributed by the learned Jew, Dr. Ad Neubauer, to the Jewish Quarterly Review in 1889. Quote, at least they know that they were separate from Judah. The captivity of Israel, exiled beyond the Euphrates, did not return as a whole to Palestine along with their brethren, the captives of Judah. This is from the Jewish Quarterly Review. At least there's no mention made of this event in the documents at our disposal. He believes them to be the subject of prophecy. Quote, in fact, he says, the return of the 10 tribes was one of the great promises of the prophets, and the advent of the Messiah is therefore necessarily identified with the epoch of their redemption. And that is correct. For years, the Jews have known the 10 tribes are separate from the Jews and didn't come back with them. That's point one. Number two, because they're students of their own scriptures, they have known for years that when Messiah returns, they're going to be brought together again. Because Ezekiel said that, the Lord will put the stick of Judah in one hand and the stick of Israel in one hand, and the coming of Messiah, he cannot come in fullness without the two sticks being joined. Well, then why did Akiba, renowned, redoubtable is what it was, redoubtable Jewish scholar, rabbi, why did he bluntly say they'll never return? Simple. Very simple. Do you want to know? Dr. Niebauer also states that Rabbi Akiba believed Bar Kochab to be the Messiah, one of the false messiahs, who was on the scene then. And because Rabbi Akiba believed that Bar Kochab was the Messiah, and that in so much as the tribes are to be gathered during the time of the Messiah, and that they were not gathered under Bar Kochab, he, Rabbi Akiba, stated the tribes would never return. Now, the sentence makes sense, doesn't it? When you, not only is no prophecy of Scripture private interpretation, no little statement of know-it-alls without checking and double-checking. Now, I can call him a redoubtable rabbi, and I can say he had the courage to state bluntly they'd never return. But I haven't told the whole story if I don't say he accepted a false Messiah, but because he honestly believed that that man on the scene was the Messiah, since the man was there and the tribes weren't together, he had to choose between this is the Messiah, or he's not the Messiah because the tribes haven't come, or the third alternative, I know he's the Messiah, the tribes aren't together, so they'll never return. Follow that? So you got to be careful, don't you? Now, the reason I got on this speech that twisted my vest all around is I don't want you to get nervous if you don't follow every little detail. I'm hitting you with a hole. And as we bring Paul on the scene, it becomes increasingly important to see that God has to be faithful to His promise, because Paul makes it clear that those 10 lost tribes are really Gentiles that will show forth the glory of God when God returns, and in the place that they were known as not His people, not having obtained mercy, they will be known as My people and as having received mercy, and will no longer say Baal, but will sing My Lord as they turn from their outcast state. And suddenly, like the dead coming to life, the dead men's bones in Ezekiel 37, they are discovered. Now, one more little clod in the field. Until the last century and a half, you say, well, how come you're reading from a Bible and it sounds different? Why, I tell you, beware, wary of seminaries. Too many professors are running around that just regurgitate without critical analysis or synthesis with their own faith or the modern times, the notes they got in school 20 years ago, that professor got in school 20 years before, that professor got in school 20 years before. They don't gestalt anything. I used to be, in fact, I was on the committee chosen to analyze what was wrong with Evangel College and turn it around at one time in Springfield, Missouri. And I was minister of education in the church where most of the professors and executives of the school attended. They put on a set of psychological gears on Sunday morning and expressed their religious faith and marched out on Monday and pulled their notes out, unsynthesized and uncriticized and unrelated to their faith, and regurgitated them to the destruction of faith of the kids the next morning in this classroom. Never would the twain meet, because it's hard work. German theological concepts have dominated the church world for years. Coming out of view of reality called German idealism that is utterly alien to the New Testament faith. And kids go through seminaries memorizing God's omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent. Don't even think through the complications as they put God in a box that gives Him the ager to sit in. Well, the Germans have dominated everything in too many fields for too long. It was the German school of history and archaeological studies that pushed onto the world until the last century a false view of history, a false view of archaeology, a false view of the whole reality of this globe. They were what's known as Helleno-Romano-centric. The classical cultures were the Greek and the Roman. And the rest of the world, they adopted the stupid Greek view that if you were non-Greek, you were barbarian. To the Greeks, the word barbarian was a generic term, the same way the Gentile is generic to a Jew. It's other than me. If you are Judea-centric, from the chosen people concept, which I believe they are chosen, but I believe God's got a basket big enough to choose some other things for His table. But if you are Judaic-centric, then there's me and everybody else. There's the Jew and everybody else the Gentile. Or if you are Greco-centric, and the only historians worthy of note, though we got 5,000 documents for biblical historians, for every one document of a Herodotus or a Plato, but if you have deified the Greco-Roman world, then every god you encounter must be related to Mount Olympus. And everything other than the Greco culture, the Greeks, were viewed by the Greeks as barbarians. Barbarian wasn't standing on your head when you eat or washing with dirt. Barbarian was non-Greek. And when the Romans moved into the Grecian vacuum and were Hellenized by the Greeks, barbarians were non-Roman, a generic term. It wasn't until the last century that archaeology and men with enough integrity to escape from the German domination of the field blew that concept to smithereens and discovered that the Greco-Roman world was not the center of culture and the universe, and that everything moved from that benchmark to some degree of lesser quality. But lo and behold, instead of some of the Thracians and the Celtians and the Scythians, barbarians, encountering the Greeks and becoming cultured, they were in fact ahead of the Greeks, and the Greeks learned some things from them. That is brand new, relatively speaking, on the scene, and I have no fear of the science contradicting me on it. The whole world of archaeology and history woke up. I remember when I did my undergraduate major in history. For the first time in the history of the university I attended, the faculty decided to pick a textbook for the general overview of European history written by some leading scholars who for the first time had the guts to write a book that centered the history of Europe in a polarized basis, giving equal emphasis to the Byzantine Empire and the Arabian Empire and the influence of the Arabs, instead of making Greece and Rome the center of everything and everything that intruded upsetting their little classical advanced apple cart. As I read the other night, Plato had a guy from Egypt tell him, "You Greeks are a bunch of dummies. Let me tell you about somebody that was in front of you." Now, as I said many weeks ago, people of faith get ridiculed because they have faith. I stood as a trembling freshman coming out of an assembly hall at Cal State University at Chico, listening to a ruthless English professor that was my English professor, saying to another, I overheard as I walked out of an assembly hall where they had shown a movie made by Moody Bible Institute on strange facts of nature that reveal some kind of creative divine power in some of the things like the little penguins of South Australia that go out for miles and come back to the exact same burrow and walk up with their little butler stride to their little holes, from that to such things as the eels that go from the Sargasso Sea. And Moody Bible Institute was in the emphasis in those days of showing God's handiwork in nature. And he walked out cursing, saying, "Faith! I hate anything that has faith." And I stood there trembling, thinking, if I'm going to get out of this school, I got to quit having faith. So I set out to find a philosophy of life that didn't require any faith. Changing majors on every degree till I got smart enough to figure out there isn't any such animal. Until I began to discover it took more faith to believe some of these so-called historians and scientists than didn't believe God. I mean, for centuries the Germans mocked Homer's Iliad as an absolute legend with no basis in fact. Took one of their own stubborn Germans to find Troy. They couldn't argue with him. He's a German. And blow their theories down the drain and prove that Homer was almost as accurate in his cartography as the Bible is in locating King Solomon's mines for an archaeologist. Well, now, in the last century, history has had to be rewritten as we understand that Greek and Rome was influenced by civilizations around them just as advanced in different ways as they were. And the deification of the Greco-Roman world is as much a brainwashing of the generations of the Western world as the communists are brainwashing their citizens with a history that they write. By the way, that one-eyed Pasha and those Arabians had more sense when Lollard got there than his archaeological teachers that thought he was a nut to dig there. Well, it sounds good to say, dear old brother, Rabbi Akiba had the courage to state bluntly, if I believed that Stan Clements was the Messiah, and the 10 tribes had to be found before the Messiah came, and Stan's the Messiah and he's sitting over there, I got a choice. Either Stan's not the Messiah or the tribes ain't ever coming back. And if I am convinced you're the Messiah, then I'm going to have the courage to bluntly say, ain't going to be no 10 tribes, friend. They didn't tell you the whole story, did they? About the only place you get the whole story is here. I'd suggest you stick around a while. You say, what's the point of what you've just said? The lost tribes were essentially undiscoverable until an entire new wealth of information began to explode in many areas in the last century and a half. That means for about 2,200 years, they were as though they were hidden. The center of the world, as the Jews used to draw maps in which Jerusalem was the center of the world, the center of the world for many centuries was Greece and Rome. Most of you have grown up in the experience of the opening of the pyramids and the tombs in Egypt, particularly the notoriety of King Tut's tomb, without understanding how revolutionary the thrust of this new knowledge was into the world frame that existed. It was as bad as the shattering illusion that the world wasn't flat. They stayed hidden. But now, as the day of the Lord draws near, and God must discover these people to themselves, the burst of knowledge enables the finding of the tracings that enable the proof of God's faithfulness to His Word to be identified. And more important, as I hinted tonight going into Romans 9, a meaning to the glory of God that recognizes that God has a people in the natural scattered through the Gentiles that He must deal with in the natural promises of God, in addition to the wondrous knowledge of the grace of God bestowed upon us in Christ and to those of us that are in Christ, that takes us out of every race save the citizenry of heaven, which will enable me to finish the teaching that I've started in some of the books. Now, you can find a seat, fellas. I have laid on you the gestalt of many sources of knowledge that all say the same thing. and I'll bet you could recite it to me, you that are listening, both in here and on radio and television, that there is a strange beginning of a distinctive tribal movement, of a distinctive tribal people with distinctive characteristics that come out of the area west of the Caspian Sea, south of the Caucasus Mountains, east of the Tigris River, in the area immediately north of the Black Sea, the Caucasus Mountains, and the Caspian Sea, shortly after their removal from the area of the Medes I've just named, and that those people's marks show a northwestern movement across Europe, and that the last identifiable, easily identifiable remnants of that tribal movement is in the islands of the Northwest in Scandinavia and in the British Isles. And that no matter where we go, be it sympathetic writers, unconcerned writers, anti-writers, and against writers, they all have to confront what they may call a mystery or a revelation. This springing up of a nomadic tribal people with an advanced civilization not recognized until recent years begins at the exact time the 10 tribes are displaced to the area of the Medes west of the Caspian Sea, at the same time that Ezra says they took a year and a half to pass through the Caucasus Mountains to unknown lands to the north. At the same time the 10 tribes disappear, a strange group of people given other names appear, called Scythians, Celts, and now Thracians. Now there is a point where some of you say, okay, I'm convinced, just get to the fine line. I don't teach that way. I want you to reach the decision yourself, not cause I reach it. And we're on a detective journey to satisfy ourselves, where are these 10 tribes? God knows where they're at, and I'll make you bet I do too. Anybody want to bet with me? Now, I've pulled this book out a few times. I took the trouble to really mark it up, read it all today, along with a few others. Thrace. Thrace and the Thracians. How many of you are intimately acquainted with Thrace? Thrace was first mentioned in the ancient lays that Homer immortalized. With San Francisco in my audience, I suppose I got to explain what lays are. And with heathen Sodom and Gomorrah, known as Hollywood. Verbal stories that carry on the traditions of a people. Thrace was first mentioned in the ancient lays that Homer immortalized. In the 6th century B.C., isn't that interesting? Here we go again. Same blamed time. Only this time, we're about 100 years further down the trail. Why is that? Because we're no longer between, get over to this finger. I got to guide that. We're no longer between here and here. See, the Caspian Sea is right here. Got that? Right there. And the Caucasus Mountains are right here. Got that? You people on radio, pay attention. Caucasus Mountains are right there. Right there. That's the Caspian Sea. Now come on, I want to go back through the mountains. There's the mountains there. That's the Black Sea. Now when the Israelites were settled by the Assyrians. They were put right here. See that? Right there, between Tabriz in modern Iran and the Caspian Sea. And Ezra says they went out through the Caucasus Mountains and settled in this broad territory north of the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. See, right up there. Well, that's just about 650 B.C. Now, another 50 years, and we are into the 6th century, out of the 7th century. It took them that long for a portion of them to go across the Black Sea and start settling rather permanently in this territory in here, which is modern Bulgaria, south of Romania, with the Danube being the boundary between Romania and Bulgaria. And south of that are the Grecian states starting to form, first with any solidarity under Philip of Macedon. South of them, Macedonia, the Dardanelles. North of them, the Danube. So in about 50 years, certain of these tribes have settled in this area. So we find, bang, Thrace was first mentioned in the ancient lays that Homer immortalized in the 6th century B.C. when the malign but highly enlightened Athenian tyrant Pisistratus had Homer's poems committed to writing. It became apparent that the epic memory of the Greeks had not played them false where Thrace and the Thracians were concerned. According to the Iliad, Thrace stretched along the Aegean coast and included the so-called Thracians of the Dardanelles and other tribes that he names. Such was the extent of Greece's knowledge of Thrace on the eve of the Trojan War in the middle of the 13th century B.C. Then came Herodotus, who, using data supplied by the Ionian geographers to add to his own, pushed to the frontiers of Thrace, or pushed the frontiers of Thrace to the Danube in the north and to the valleys of Strymon and the Axis in the west. In the 1st century A.D., the Romans created 3 provinces. So he's telling us they knew some people were there without identifying them, clear back to 1200 B.C. But the Thracians are first mentioned in the 6th century B.C., and there is a particular tribe that takes shape from the Iliad onward, when it's written down in those dates, and they are bounded by the Danube on one side and the Dardanelles on the other. 1st century, the Romans created 3 provinces, Upper and Lower Moesia. Isn't that interesting? It's a cognate of Moses. North of the Balkan range and along the Danube from Belgrade to the mouth of that great river, and Thrace. So he created 3 provinces, Upper and Lower Moesia and Thrace. In the 2nd century A.D., Trajan, victorious over the Dacians in the north, the entire territory of the Thracian tribes in southeastern Europe was made into an administrative unit and incorporated in the Roman Empire, while the territory north of the Danube, where the Thracian tribes had just been subjected, was made the province of Dacia. But apart from its geography, what did the Greeks actually know of Thrace and the Thracians? What was their idea of this intriguing people and the land they inhabited? Herodotus called them barbarians. Remember, I told you that. But in his day, there was nothing pejorative or contemptuous about the term. It merely meant that the writer considered their world to be less developed than his own. Not only that, but some authors even extolled barbarian virtues, contrasting them with the depravity of society in their day. The Thracians left the historical stage in the 6th and 7th centuries A.D., passing their traditions to the Slavs and the Bulgars, who founded the first Bulgarian state in 681. Probably the first to discover ancient Thrace was Count Marsigli, who traveled along the Danube in 1721, was the first to mention the strange relics from Thracian times to be seen there. 2 most important aspects of Thracian studies were religion and language, the latter finally being assigned a place among the Indo-European languages. Homer asserted that the material culture of the Thracians and their allies, the Trojans, was just as high as that of their enemies. So Homer recognized the quality of this people. Between two world wars, the German school, just as I told you, dominated historiography with its obstinate and inflexible philosophical interpretation of the historical process, focusing all studies on Athens and Greece, Rome and Italy. This Helleno and Italocentrism were nothing but an instrument for reducing the history of the Eastern Mediterranean and of the ancient world in general into two radically opposed closed systems, one of which, the Greco-Roman, was the cultural center, and the other, a bunch of dumb barbarians. The only remedy, therefore, was to reject. If you're going to understand, well, it says the natural result of such thinking was to bring Thracian studies to a standstill. I'd say it was to bring all study to a standstill of any culture not centered in the Greco-Roman sphere. And the only way that it's ever started to blossom in recent years is to reject the Greek interpretation and look for the Thracian. Study the Thracians, study the tribes, go in without the prejudice and try to figure out who these people are. What is Thraciology? It is the history of the peoples between the Danube and the Aegean. Now, is it the history of those peoples as seen by the Greeks? Is it the history of the population when they became four Roman provinces as seen by the Romans? Or is it, listen to this word, or is it the history of the Thracian dispersion, which had its center in the Balkan Peninsula, but included regions as far afield as the Dnieper and Dniester basins? Now, if we're going to start looking for these people, assuming maybe they exist, are you interested in figuring out if God been keeping His word, or if He's lost these people? Then we better start looking for them without the Greco-Roman bias that there's a bunch of strange birds that descended somewhere from out of the plateaus of northern Europe. Nobody in the world knows anything about them except they rode horses and killed and were barbarians. The written sources and material show that the territories between the Danube and the Aegean, the Vardar-Struma valleys and the Black Sea, were the actual tribal and cultural centers of the Thracian world. So Thrace was but a periphery of a larger movement. The areas north of the Danube were an integral part of it, their population, its history, and civilization having the same characteristics. Now, leaving aside the earliest periods in the area, the Neolithic and Bronze Ages, still in dispute, the second great period in the history of ancient Thrace was that between the end of the second millennium B.C., about 1000 B.C., and the end of the 6th century B.C. Something really happened, including profound changes owing to the introduction of the use of iron. It is not surprising, therefore, that the next third period, that between the end of the 6th, which is about the time they settled and had that vast territory we talked about last night from Moscow to Warsaw and from the Caspian Sea to the Black Sea, was an era of great material, cultural, and political advance. It was then... Now, wait a minute, folks. I'll show you something. I think I got it here. Somewhere. More than anybody in the history of mankind, it was God's people going into the Promised Land that developed a philosophy and an expectancy of tribal identification and territory, right or wrong. When they went into the promised land, the land was divided. Here we have the map of it. Judah, just north of Hebron, Simeon, who later would move to a coastal city, Benjamin, Reuben, Gad, Ephraim, Dan, Manasseh, Issachar, Manasseh, Naphtali, Zebulun, Asher. These were definite territories laid out for each tribe to have an identity. More than anybody, we got 10 tribes carried into bondage. 50 years after they're in bondage, which would take them to about 670 B.C., Darius, in a heathen inscription, says they rebelled. They are said by Esdras to take counsel among themselves about 100 years after they went into bondage, which would take them to about 622 B.C., and in a year and a half went through the upper valleys of the Euphrates River, through the Caucasus Mountains, the Sarmatian or Sarmatian Gate, to lands unknown. They carried with themselves a past history of identity by tribe. It was then, between the end of the 6th century, that means they'd be in the area just north of the Caucasus Mountains between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, about 620 B.C. Give them 50 years and they're coming down the Thracian Peninsula and moving on up toward and north of the Danube, toward Moscow and toward Warsaw, if they keep moving that direction. About that same date, this book says, it was then that many tribal unions amounting to states came into being south of the Danube and along its lower reaches. These were important centers of production, building, and arts and craft. Of these tribal unions, and names one that was the most organized, and in another spot, as I skip along, it'll say these centers had an advanced communication between them. The fourth period in the pre-Roman history starts with a social and political crisis of the Balkan Peninsula that began in the 3rd century. That 3rd century is when the Greeks begin the upheaval. The problem here is that it's not enough just to record the presence of the Thracian tribes in various parts of the world. What we want to know, listen to this, what we want to know is the reason for their being there. Why are they there? And these reasons are to be sought in Thrace alone. Not some guy who sits down and decides, because he's accepted a Messiah, that it rules out even any looking for him. As more and more archaeological discoveries were made in Crete, Mycenae, Asia Minor, and hither in Central Asia, they provided proof of the variety of social and political structures and showed how relatively equal were the cultural achievements of the ancient world. Only the most conservative can still support Hellenocentrism. This archaeologist blows the German school out the window. No longer is the Hellenic Greek world the king. It has been established that here, not the time has come when it should be realized that Athens is not the yardstick. It has been established that here, the variety of forms that's north of the Black Sea and in Thrace is much greater than was previously thought, and that the ancient world did not develop along one ascending line culminating in the Parthenon, but that many diverse things were happening, many directions along parallel lines which rarely intersected. Today, the ancient world is seen as a mosaic of closed local systems, I would say, many of which have been neglected totally in both history and archaeology for centuries. It was only certain areas, for instance, southeastern Europe and Asia Minor, where they influenced each other. Since the time of Sleeman, Troy's discoverer, the idea of the Greek miracle of the 5th century B.C. has been so demolished it's no longer taken seriously. And for centuries, they ruled the intellectual world. And they were wrong. And once more, the Bible is going to be proven right. If you believe the Bible, you would know that when Ezekiel picked up those two sticks, Israel's got to be somewhere. If you believe the Bible, when Paul says they're Gentiles, but they're still going to fulfill what God said through Hosea, you know they're there. And to me, funny brain that I am, I got to find them or bust. A further difficulty is presenting the Thracian viewpoint of history of that country is the absence of a script. If you got in trouble for your religion, would you quit writing it down? Seems to me like I remember one of the features of the settlers in Ireland was they didn't have a written language at the outset. Then Ogham comes along. But Ogham was designed as the first written language that you could keep anybody from figuring out what you were saying. Because by prior agreement, you could make the slash marks mean something different as you put your hands up different ways. I didn't say anything. But you could say watermelon, pumpkin, peach, apple, pear, pomegranate. And by pre-designation, you had a secret code. A people who could communicate among themselves, but left no script. In order to get to the genuine article, the researcher has to remove the glosses which the Greeks and the moderns have put on the text or the excavated objects to get to the real truth about the Thracians. As a rule, each territory has been given the name of the tribal group mentioned by the Greeks when they looked at them as most powerful. And that's why the method of the German cartographic or map-making school of the past century has to be totally revised, and as should everything that's been written about the historical geology of Thrace. It's a date on this. September 1976. The Institute of Thracology, the Bulgarian Academy of Sciences' newest institute. And this publication, 1976, says you've got to start all over, friends, in 1976. Everything they've said has been wrong. And the Greeks wrote a map of the ancient world and didn't know what they're talking about. The second book of Iliad shows that the term Thrace then referred to a very limited area. But by the end of the 6th century B.C., I don't make this up, friends. By the end of the 6th century B.C., it had gradually been adopted as the ethnic and geographic name for the territory south of the Danube and the inhabitants living there in the 6th century. It is still being debated whether the first Thrace was on Hellespont or along the lower reaches of Struma, as some linguists think today. During the first half of the first millennium B.C., between 1000 and 500 B.C., the extent of the territory known under this name gradually expanded. In Homer's epic, only three tribes were named. But by the time of Herodotus, the famous Greek historian, the number had increased to 12 as more tribes moved in. To what extent may we use the term tribe outside its social context? I seem to remember that the first cultured people to arrive in Ireland were so advanced that they were deified by their conquerors as the Tuatha tribe, the Danann tribe of Dan, Now here this Bulgarian scientist has got to explain the use of the word tribe. To what extent may we use the term tribe? You Greek writers never speak of a tribe, ethnos, but simply use the ethnonym. We have added the term tribe as a hint at the social character of organization, but there's no need to say the tribe of Jettai, instead just the Jettai. What is most probable is that the ethnonym derives from the name of a great family. Well, how did the tribes of Israel derive? Name of a family. Herodotus, for example, writes, the Bessai were a family of Sotre. Now, it's clear the name Sotre was that of a family now extinct that had a strong political powers and that the name had later been assumed by a large tribal group. But the Greeks didn't really know. Many coins of the tribes in southwestern Thrace have been discovered and have been dated to the late 6th and early 5th centuries B.C. That's where they find everything. The period when the number of ethnonyms in Thrace first, the period when tribes in Thrace first increased substantially. Some of the coins bear the name Getas, king of Adonai. As the ethnonym Jettai was used in northeastern Thrace, the use of Getas in the southwest was explained as being due to an invasion of the southwest by the Getai and their subjection of the Adonai. Then the coins were said to be counterfeit and the question was dropped. Nobody searched the reason. But, how the scientists argue, but then it was discovered the coins are genuine. And the question still remains to be answered. It is our conviction, these scientists, that the name Jettas was used in Edonian coins because it was a Thracian royal name. The royal origin of this name shows, though indirectly, that the Jettai family were a family of northeastern Thrace up around the Black Sea, and that they ruled that territory. They were, in fact, the family of the god-king Zalmoxis, which literally cognates into Chief Moses. In actual fact, Thrace was made up of large and small territories, which are now gradually, by archaeology, being put on the map. The central part of present-day northern Bulgaria, referred to in the sources, is the land of the Moesians, worshipping Chief Moses, Zalmoxis. Investigations now being carried out show that these small territories were geographic and economic entities, just like the tribes of Israel, that they had a system of settlements, cult, and economic centers, and were connected with neighboring regions by a dense communications network. It was here that the people were concentrated and organized in families and family unions. It would thus, he finally concludes, be acceptable. It would thus be acceptable to use the word tribe. Isn't that marvelous? There was no evolution in religious and political life. Hero, the mounted Thracian deity, was revered with equal zeal in all parts of the country. It is obvious that Thrace was extremely conservative in all social, political, and religious aspects, and that from the 6th or 5th century B.C., there they go, Thrace was the largest country in southeastern Europe and one of the largest in antiquity. Just another little piece in the puzzle. Well, where did they come from? Huh? Where did they come from? Now, who is this Zalmoxis? I'll show you a picture of him. Moses learned in all the warfare of Egypt. Anybody got proof he never rode a horse? Huh? Anybody in front of me got proof he never wore a horse? I mean, never rode a horse? He never wore one, but never rode one. There he is again. There's Zalmoxes, the god hero of all the Thracians. The Greek writers, beginning with Herodotus, were convinced, listen, that it was Zalmoxes who had taught the Thracians to believe in the immortality of the soul. Herodotus described the clever way in which Zalmoxes imparted his doctrine to the foolish Thracians. He taught them that neither he nor... Got to turn the page. We'll do that later. Herodotus figured out how Moses tricked them into believing immortality. And it's a strange story that would fit. How many of you know that these Egyptians had a memory? And they had, or rather these Israelites had a memory. And they had a full recollection that nobody knew where Moses was buried. It is certain that if they didn't have all the five books of the Pentateuch, they had Deuteronomy. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And he buried him in a valley in the land of Moab, over against Beth Peor, that no man knoweth of his sepulchre unto this day. That great and marvelous leader, nobody knows where he was buried. A mystery of a departed leader. Go to Jude in the New Testament. Now, if you think that God wrote the New Testament by coming down and grabbing Jude by the nape of the neck and said, "Give me your finger," and then he wrote the book of Jude like he wrote the Ten Commandments in a stone, it isn't going to mean anything to you. But Jude was aware of the traditions as Paul carried about the Didache with him. He was aware of Jewish scripture. This was a long-standing fact of knowledge in the Jewish scriptural traditions. Yet Michael the archangel, when contending with the devil, he disputed about the body of Moses, durst not bring against him a railing accusation, but said, "The Lord rebuke thee." Put Jude, which comes from ancient tradition, in his knowledge of that fact, and go back to Deuteronomy, that nobody knows where Moses was buried. Satan and Michael the archangel wrestling over the body of Moses, and Michael the archangel winning the wrestling match, rebuking him in the name of the Lord, and taking Moses and burying him in a secret place. Now remember that when I come back to the little dangler and tell you how Herodotus has explained the way in which Moses tricked him into believing in an afterlife. Not only to believe in an afterlife. Oh, well, I'll get back to that later. That didn't originate with the Greeks. Does the weight of evidence keep saying the same thing? Or not? Give me, I want to know. I want you to tell me. Talk to me. Associated with our forefathers at different epochs of their wanderings, overland or by sea, Oh, did you know, by the way, that when Deborah prophesied in 1250 B.C., that she said the Danites, Dan was already in ships and had a navy? Remember that? That means, you know, we got not only the overland bunch to deal with, I haven't yet treated the ones that went in boats. And by the way, we got Ezekiel 17 dangling. But Dan had a navy in 1250 B.C. Just thought I'd tell you that. Associated with our forefathers, different epochs of their wanderings overland or by sea, from their far eastern home to their new home in wherever, we find the tribal names Sumerians. I'm deliberately pronouncing them a certain way. Cimbrians and Cimri. We Americans pronounce a lot of words like that, like Caesar. The Germans take their word and just call him Kaiser. Oh, by the way, why, I said this a few weeks ago, but it's obvious got a lot of people watching tonight, and this is another reason, not only the field theory that keeps piling the hole on, but some of you got to remember, I am trying to catch up people each night however I can before I come to pulling the threads together that haven't listened every night as you have. Gary, can you give me a number for those that are ordering tapes? They're driving some of my people nuts saying, well, how do we order the tapes on the lost tribes? You got a number sequence that starts them, Gary?
I don't recall a number, but I'll find out for you.
How long will it take you?
Three, 4 minutes.
I'll call back in 5 minutes and tell you. Now, we Americans say Caesar, Sumerians, Cimbrians, Cimri. These names must never be pronounced soft as if C were S. It was Cimmerioi or Cimbri, and Celtic should be Celtic, as always pronounced, when correctly pronounced for the Welsh portion, the people who live in Cimri. So is Caesar can be Caesar. In reverse, Sumerians, Cimri, and Cimbrians can be Cimmerians, Cimbrians, and Cimri. In the great inscription of King Darius on the rocks of Behistun, remember we were at that point just before we had old Lawyer digging up Nimrod with the one-eyed Pasha charging down on him. In the great inscription of King Darius on the rocks of Behistun in Persia, a list of tribal names is given in each of the three languages in which the records are there inscribed. The people named Saka in one version are called Cimri in the second. Obviously, Saka and Cimri are the two names for the same race, because these are sayings written down in three languages of identical words. Now, I've already traced that Saka traces itself back to the dropping of the first letter, Isaka, and simply refers to the descendants of Isaac. Obviously, Saka and Cimri are two names for the same race. Strange that we should have Saxons and Cimri, the sons of Saka and Cimri, side by side in the British Isles. I'm getting back to that northwest again. On the way between east and west, halfway from the banks of the Araxes and the source of Euphrates, in that journey which Esdras and Herodotus, the Jewish writer and the Greek writer, describe as being performed by the 10 tribes and our Scythian ancestors, they are described as being taken to Arsareth, which the other night I pointed out can be traced to the Hebrew Ar, which means city or hill, city or hill of Sareth, or an alternate word used in those historic sources, the Cimmerian land, where lies the Crimea. In the Crimea, a great discovery has been made of no less a find than 4 cemeteries filled with ancient Hebrew tombstones, now exhibited in the great Imperial Museum at Petrograd. The character in which the epitaphs on these 4 cemeteries are inscribed is not the square Hebrew used by the Jews after their captivity in Babylon, but belongs to the older Hebrew alphabet of the Moabite stone and the mason's marks on the temple foundations built under King Solomon. And the dates on them are only intelligible if the dead these inscriptions honored were Hebrews, whose language predates the changes in the language reflected by the Jews when they come back from Babylon. Thus, as Ezra said, the 10 lost tribes who would predate the change in the Hebrew character to the square shape that came after they came back from Babylon and would be carried to the area of the Medes, and in the middle of the 7th century, as Ezra said, would go through the Caucasus Mountains to the land of the Cimmerians. Various suggestions have been made as to the connection. The inscriptions of Sargon, which I read translated directly the other night, and the Assyrian conquerors, the last city they conquered being Samaria, since Samaria was founded by Umri, the 6th king of the northern kingdom, they called the inhabitants of the whole kingdom, this is the Assyrian designation for the house of Israel, Beth Qumri, which means house of Umri. And Assyrian inscriptions refer to these people taken of the 10 tribes into bondage as Beth Qumri, or in some occasions, son of Qumri, which is the root of Kimri, Kimri, and Cimmerians. Well, who are they? It designated the people who settled in the area of Crimea, or the Cimmerians. So as Scythians is an abstract word that describes nomads, and as the Thracians were nomad tribes that began to settle and advance in ever-increasing numbers as they came across the Black Sea, so were these people called Cimmerians because they represent the Beth Qumri who moved north of the Caucasus Mountains and settled in the land of the Cimmerians, which designated a geographic area where the Beth Qumri settled. And they began to get lost to history because nobody would tie together the Saka, the Kimri, the Beth Qumri, the Cimmerians, with the Scythians, which gave the character of their nomadic state, which Herodotus commended them for because they kept all their possessions in wagons and were not tied to any place. And the Saka, and the Cimmeri end up in the British Isles as the Saxons, and the Kimri, the Welsh. What if they're the same? Getting kind of ludicrous to say that, isn't it? You say, well, Isn't this just Old Testament speculation? As somebody who jumped the gun on me tonight points out, because I started moving into the New Testament. I said, once the field is there, things leap out and hit you in the face. Jude knew the tradition of the wrestling between Michael and the devil over the body of Moses. Paul knew that the lost tribes were referred to as Gentiles, and yet the glory of the Gentiles, God's election in them, would still be fulfilled, as Hosea said, and he leaves no doubt that they became Gentiles, and the explanation is the law of divorcement, the bill of divorcement, put them away. They're no longer married to God. Don't you think James, the brother of our Lord, who wrote an epistle, knew they existed? How's his epistle open? James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad, greeting. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into divers temptations. The church world for years has written the Jews and everybody else off. Because to spiritualize that one, you've got to eliminate the Jews. He didn't just say the 10 tribes. And as Josephus said, only 2 of the tribes are under Rome. And James was writing while Rome was still the conqueror. Now, you can't cut his sentence in half. If you say it's a spiritual message only, and then you got to say the church is the 12 tribes and ain't no Jews either. You can't say, well, there's Jews, and James is writing to them, and then to the Gentiles. No, he's writing to the 12 tribes. And by the way, a lot of contradictions in the New Testament just go straight down the drain when you realize James knew who he was writing to, and so did God. James has been polarized for years against Paul. James was writing to the 12 tribes. Paul wrote to the Gentiles. Unless you get that in your head, you'd be like a football player that doesn't know which way to run or throw the ball because you don't know where your goal is. Isn't the Bible fascinating? If you don't, you know, mess around. Do you know something? Do you know Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ to the strangers scattered? You know what that word scattered means? Huh? He could just as easily say the strangers of Jezreel. Elect. I mean, John Calvin just went bananas with this. Because he limited it totally. Do you know that the whole Christian world has eliminated the Jews and the 10 tribes from New Testament study? And have had every single epistle strictly limited in application to the church? You know that? The epistles are for the church. For the evangelical church and historic church has said for years. These epistles are for the church. They refused to accept the fact that there was war in the New Testament church between the disciples who saw their ministry, the conversion of the elect race, the communicating. Right now in the modern world, there are Jews for Jesus. That's what most of the disciples were. Jews for Jesus type people. Paul was specifically called and made God's voice to the Gentiles, which includes the 10 tribes and all the rest of the Gentiles. The other disciples continued to focus their ministry in the portion of the epistle writing to their brethren, the Jews. When they finally began to branch out, James wrote a letter to all the tribes. But he's writing to the tribes still. He's finally moved from Jews to those portion of the Gentiles, which are the other tribes. Peter is saying in his own words, he's writing to the elect scattered. We know that Paul wrote to the Galatians that we know in history for the 10 tribes. Now, again, I got people listening to me going to make the same mistake that those that made a British Israelite out of me prematurely. Don't you go boxing me up yet. I just happen to think it's kind of interesting. Although the spotlight of world events remains fixed on the Middle East, the focus is sometimes shifted away from Iran, an ancient land where Jews lived for more than 2,000 years. The secret Jews of Iran. No, I'm going to go to the Jewish buccaneers first. I'll put that down and say, Scott, you got to take the dangle out of that and get to that next time. Good night, everybody.